United States of America versus Crabtree and other appellants. And counsel are ready to go. We'll start with Mr. Mendez, who represents appellant Russo.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and good morning. And may it please the court, Joaquin Mendez on behalf of Dr. Russo. Unless at some point Your Honors have special inquiries in other areas, I would like to focus my remarks on the sufficiency of the evidence, the correctness of the deliberate ignorance instruction, and the sentencing issues, particularly the enhancement, the four-level enhancement for his Dr. Russo's leadership role. As to the sufficiency argument, of course, it's we know that the jury must have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Dr. Russo knew that the materials and the information he was signing was false, and that he willfully joined in the conspiracy to do so. We, on this side of the courtroom, all would like to be Dr. Abreu in the Wilder decision, and the reason I think that that's important is because Dr. Abreu's conviction, of course, was vacated despite her presence in a large, massive Medicare fraud scheme that resulted in billings of over $200 million. And this court found that, notwithstanding the existence of some evidence of that she should have known what was going on, and notwithstanding some things that she admittedly did wrong, the proof actually produced at trial was insufficient to support the conviction.
Well, and there were, who was the owner of Healthcare Solutions?
That was Armando Gonzalez, who...
He testified at the trial, right?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
He did, along with multiple directors, and they all testified against Dr. Russo, who earned more than $877,000 for admittedly signing whatever medical documents were put in front of him without review. He rarely, if ever, met with patients or reviewed their medical needs. He was a part of a conversation where another employee expressed concern over the, quote, bones in the closets, the evil secrets of Healthcare Solutions. He was aware that they were recycling patients to increase billings. He was involved in conversations with employees where they were instructed to delete references to Alzheimer's and dementia medications on patients' profiles. And so your argument is that evidence is insufficient upon which a reasonable jury could rely to conclude that he was a part of this conspiracy?
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is that that evidence is a summary that is not exactly faithful to the actual testimony at trial.
No, this is in the record.
For example, the argument that my client instructed Ms. Pamping to delete those medications, her testimony actually, I'll quote, was that it was at 836-908, it was Ms. Feas, the one who told me to go ahead and delete it, every medication referring to those. So, and I could say the same thing about some of the other premises. For example, it is true he didn't see patients, and that was, had he seen the patients, then the argument that he would not have known that they were ineligible would fail. All I can say, Judge, is that the direct testimony of knowledge is almost non-existent.
Well, the signing of all the documents, that distinguishes from the Abreu case. He signed dozens of documents. Wouldn't that indicate the knowledge of what was taking place?
Well, if he had ever read them, or there been any evidence that he read them, and unfortunately, I'm here to argue someone who completely abdicated his responsibilities as a professional, but there's no evidence that he read them, that there's evidence that he knew that they were false, and the mere signing of the documents, I submit, is insufficient, and the remark about the bones in the business. I went back to that again and again because what Mr. Lehman says, and we have to take him for his word, assuming that, you know, based on the jury's verdict, is that he asked Dr. Russo what would happen if Dr. Manley ever learned about the bones in the closet. So it's implicit in that remark that Dr. Manley was not told anything about the bones in the closet, and there's no discussion about what that means. So I understand, and Judge Wilson, I'm not arguing that there's a complete and total lack of evidence. I don't think that's the standard. I'm just arguing that in light of the totality of the evidence and the lack of direct evidence, you would think after that many years of association with these people that someone would say, maybe Armando Gonzalez, I told him, I'm going to pay you to do this and that. The other co-conspirators openly discussed the conspiracy. Nobody did that with my client, and that was a point of emphasis in the Wilner case.
All right, I think we have your argument, counsel.
Thank you. My time has exceeded. I would only say that as to the role offense, again, the basis for that increase was the claim or the idea that he instructed people to delete medications. I hope I've shown that that was not Dr. Rousseau. And the deliberate ignorance instruction, I think it's laid out. The case proceeded under the theory of actual knowledge. By giving that instruction is my argument that it diluted the government's burden of proof. Thank you. And by the way, without objection from the government, I would ask leave to adopt Mr. Clue's argument on the dismissal of the juror. I anticipated it would be done. I tried to do it, and I absolutely just failed to do it in my reply brief.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Klug.
Good morning. We've raised four issues, and one of them is the dismissal of the juror issue. I think that is perhaps the simplest issue, although perhaps the most interesting issue is the collateral estoppel issue. On the collateral estoppel issue, our position is that the Larkin case in this circuit, the Ohion case in this circuit, and the Supreme Court's decisions in Yeager and Bravo Fernandez make it absolutely clear that the government cannot go and request a Pinkerton instruction, proceed at least in part on a Pinkerton theory, and then when they lose all of the counts that everybody, at least my client, 100%, there was no question
Why couldn't a rational jury conclude that the therapists were part of the conspiracy but still not liable under Pinkerton?
Because of the, again, and this is the focus of the case law, is a fact-specific focus. It's not merely a theoretical. There could be a case where that's true. There could be some other case. But in this case, as the government's brief reflects, where the government uses and argues to this court evidence that my client's failure to respond affirmatively, to deny her involvement in these very notes in the second trial. This case was tried on the theory that this was the therapist's role. All they had to do was produce these notes, and that was their function there. They had to either be signed or somebody had to sign for them, and that was their function. That was the case. In the first trial, it was absolutely undisputed that the notes were false, that they were part of the conspiracy. The sole defense that the defendants made was to blind their eyes in their closing arguments. They blinded their eyes to the Pinkerton instruction and said my client had nothing to do with it.
But there were other purposes to the conspiracy and other objectives. I mean, for example, in addition to the notes, there were the allegations of kickbacks. There were the allegations of not actually providing therapy in the sessions, in the group therapy sessions, instead showing movies or whatever the case may have been. And so how would you respond to that with respect to the acquittals on the substantive counts?
Well, first, the government overread the Larkin rehearing decision. Larkin rehearing, there was an affirmative basis for the court to say, well, the jury has not reached a decision on these substantive acts, but has reached a decision on these substantive acts. Hence, we will say that the government can go back and they cannot proceed in any way on this conspiracy in the manner that is addressed in the acquitted counts. Not just the acquitted counts themselves, in the manner. So that entire, even under that theory, what you would be lopping off of this case is the head, the arms, and the legs of the government's case against this defendant. They didn't go back to the second trial and say, okay, forget about the false notes. That was their case in the second trial, just as was their case in the first trial. It's their case in front of you now. And so whatever theoretical possibility that might be from an interpretation of Larkin.
Even assuming that to be the case, the instruction that was actually read and that was provided to the jury, it seems to me that a reasonable jury likely understood it in its natural meaning, which was, it says, so regarding a substantive count, meaning the false statements, if you have first found a defendant charged in that count guilty of the crime of conspiracy, as charged in count one, you may also find that defendant guilty of any crime, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me the natural reading of this is that it does set up first finding the defendant charged, first finding the defendant guilty of conspiracy as charged in count one as a precondition for finding liability under the Pinkerton instruction on the substantive counts. And why wouldn't it be that a reasonable jury would understand it that way and not ever get to the substantive count since it mistried and hung on the conspiracy count?
Well, I note that the government is no longer relying on that theory because under Larkin, that theory is no longer viable for them to argue. Larkin, unfortunately, I wasn't able to come up with the Larkin decision in the district court, but it came up on appeal, fortunately. And so we know that the law is that Pinkerton is not treated that way for purposes of the collateral estoppel argument, as we have a direct holding by this court that is binding precedent on that issue. Secondly, I think that it would be the one thing in the law that it was not a special verdict. Other than a special verdict, nothing in the jury instruction, in any case law I've ever seen on jury instructions, treats jury instructions that way. And it's contrary to the actual law of Pinkerton, it's contrary to the intended purpose of Pinkerton, and it's basically an afterthought that, if assuming that's true, that still would not change the law of this circuit. And what the instruction instructed, like every instruction, is directed to each individual juror. It doesn't say you can't look at this theory until all 11 other jurors agree with you. So that while it's a novel idea, it runs straight into precedent, and I commend the government for giving up on that theory at this point. The other issues that we raised are very substantial as well. The issue of dismissing a juror with...
Is there an objection to that?
Yes, it was certainly by my client and certainly by Mr. Russo, but as the government points out, all defendants adopted all objections.
That would be an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court. It seems to me that you could disagree as a matter of discretion, but where was the abuse?
The abuse is, first of all, in dismissing the juror ex parte without even giving the defendants an opportunity. In other words, the district court announces the district court came into court on this day after Mr. Mendez had argued his case to this juror, who was an African American, as was his client. The district court announces, it starts court at 9:08 in the morning. Approximately 2 or 3 minutes after that, says the juror is 15 minutes late and she's overslept. I've excused her. Period. Bring in the jury. Nothing told to the jury about it because it's just done.
Was that the first time that juror was late?
I have reviewed that record from cover to cover more than once. Nobody was ever late. The judge started one day, this particular judge has a practice of starting a few minutes early. If it sets a case for 8 o'clock, lawyers know to be there at 7:45.
Were you a trial counsel?
I wasn't in the courtroom at the case, but I can read because they have the times. Carlene Horenkamp, the court reporter who writes,
were you one of the trial counsel?
I was not on the, I was not, I did not file an appearance as court.
The judge did say, though, that the juror had been late several times, and I thought, I may also be incorrect here, but I thought the judge said, I thought there was evidence in the record that the juror would be 45 minutes late, not 15 minutes late that day.
There's no evidence.
But here's the point. There's nothing that refutes the judge's statement on the record that the juror had been late several days. But you're saying, just looking at the record, it looks like the juror wasn't late. But there's nothing, there's no objection or anything on the record or any correction. There's nothing like that.
Yes, there is. Mr. Mendez says that. He says that's the first I've ever heard of anything like that. And then Mr. Rodriguez joins in. This is not a made-up issue. This is a judge who acted very precipitously because he was upset that the juror was 15 minutes late.
How are the defendants prejudiced by the substitution of an alternate juror?
Again, even better than in the Larkin situation with the Larkin case where I have a case directly on point, I have Peek v. Kemp, which is an en banc decision of this court.
How are they prejudiced?
Pardon me? It says, how are we prejudiced? How is he prejudiced? He had just argued his case. to one of the few remaining African-American jurors. He's got an African-American juror. I would feel prejudiced. Personally, I would feel very prejudiced. But and the other defendants are all minority group members. There's prejudice to it. The point about it, though, is this court said, in its en banc decision, you don't go there. You don't look to. And the Supreme Court has said, you don't look to prejudice. It's a simple.
Had the juror been white, male, is that the distinguishing characteristic here, that he was replaced by a non-minority juror, or is it simply a question of exercise of discretion on tardiness?
I'm simply responding to the if the law were the case that you had to show that I really needed that particular jury, we can show that in this case. We don't have to show that in the law. The law is that, yeah, you can't just say a juror is a few minutes late, I've kicked her off. You can't. I'm sorry. That's an abuse of discretion. And to do it again.
So it doesn't matter. The race issue doesn't matter here.
It matters if you're looking for prejudice. But you don't look for prejudice. If you're looking for prejudice, it's there. It's certainly there. We lost another juror later on. And again, that's when the issue was raised again by Mr. Mendez. Because he's trying to keep some racial balance on the juror for his client. We join in. The point is, it doesn't have to be prejudice. The Supreme Court said it. We cited that case, the Davis case. We cited the other cases we cited. It says, you have to, this is not a little thing where somebody's, you coughed once in court, you're out.
So how long should the judge have waited?
He should have conducted a hearing on it, and we should have analyzed it.
The juror wasn't there.
I understand, but apparently the juror was available by phone. And we could have immediately addressed the matter, but the judge had already ruled without even giving it the defense a chance. And at the time he ruled, had excluded her, it was sometime before 9:08, with court starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. So we don't know. We don't even know the context. We have an ex parte conversation based on a false fact.
We let you go way over, Mr. Klug. We understand the argument.
I know. I'm late on my time.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz.
Good morning, Your Honors, and my name is Ken Swartz on behalf of Ms. Crabtree. I'm going to pick up on the argument regarding the collateral estoppel, and I would phrase the issue, Judge Wilson, in this manner, that a truly rational jury concluding that the defendant, Ms. Crabtree, did not make a materially false statement in connection with the delivery of the health care benefits would have acquitted Ms. Crabtree of the conspiracy. The delivery of health care benefits, it was a substantive counts. The counts 6 and 7 were inextricably intertwined with this conspiracy. To respond to Judge Rosenbaum's comment about there was evidence regarding other activity going on, movies, things that were not related to therapies, that is exactly what these therapy notes were tied into. The fact that there were other activities going on, yet these therapy notes, in particular count 6 and 7, were saying that these people were giving statements as if they were truly giving therapy, receiving therapy, and acknowledging that their therapy was working and talking about how their therapy was working. The Pinkerton instruction requires one element, that is to find that this defendant was part of a conspiracy, and then these statements were made by this defendant or by others. This jury acquitted the defendant of the substantive offense under those instructions, and the element, an element of that instruction was the conspiracy. To say that the jury was hung on count one, therefore the jury must not have considered that, is a violation of the Supreme Court's case in Yeager, which says you cannot interpret a hung count in deciding what the jury decided with regard to other counts in connection with collateral estoppel. So it was error by the court below to say violation of Yeager, to say, well, because they were hung, therefore, there's no way they would have considered the Pinkerton instruction. The court instructs them, they must consider it, that's what the law of the circuit is, and they obviously did consider it because these notes were completely intertwined. That's what the government hammered away at. They said the therapists were part of the assembly line, and their role was to doctor clone. They used the clone repeatedly in the final argument, that they cloned those notes, and that was what the therapist did. That's the exclusive thing that the therapist did in that trial. Thank you, ladies. Your honors. Unless the court has any questions, I'll sit down.
Well, one question. The indictment charges the specific notes that were at issue. But you take that now to be all of the notes, whether or not they have been charged in the indictment.
Well, as a matter of fact, in the first trial, the government offered not just the two notes that were subject of counts 6 and 7, but an additional set of notes pertaining to that patient, and in those additional set of notes were cloned notes. In other words, where they would say the repeated same things time after time after time. I cited that in the reply brief, and there's a footnote. I listed all of those. So they went further in the first trial, not limiting just to those two counts, but to many other notes from that therapist. In the second trial, they went back and even had Agent Rivera talk about how Ms. Crabtree had made a false statement when she was questioned about those very same notes, the very same notes that were the subject of the first trial. That was an additional reason why there was a double jeopardy problems with the second trial. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Pierce. Mr. Webb, I'm sorry.
May it please the court, Aubrey Webb on behalf of the appellant, Liliana Marks. I wanted to address Judge Rosenbaum's concern about the jury instruction in the first trial. Your Honor, my response to the question you previously asked is there's no required order that the jury has to consider count one and then go to count 2 and 11. The Pinkerton instruction is not optional. A natural reading of the jury instructions could be that the jurors looked at, for my client, it was counts 10 and 11, they looked at those notes in a vacuum. They didn't consider count one. They fully read Pinkerton, and when they read it, they go through the steps of liability. Was she a member of the conspiracy? Did somebody act in furtherance of the conspiracy? And was that act foreseeable? That's a natural reading that the jury considered fully those three elements and determined they rejected those. And when you read that's another natural reading of the jury instructions. And also, as counsel just said, the court cannot look at the fact that count one, it was a hung jury. At the Ash decision, the Yeager decision, the Owen decision, says over and over that this court cannot look at what happens in a previous trial.
But the problem is we're talking about what the jury instructions mean. So we're not talking about what the actual outcome of the other trial was. The problem is, in looking at what the jury instructions mean, if the jury instructions are written in such a way that the jury understands them reasonably to mean they stop at the point where it says, if you have first found conspiracy, because they haven't found that. I mean, that to me seems different than looking at what the meaning of and trying to read the tea leaves on what the meaning of a hung jury on the conspiracy count was.
I agree with Your Honor. That could be one possible reading of it. But in this case, I think there's two readings. It doesn't explicitly say, if you don't find the conspiracy in count one, then disregard all further Pinkerton instructions when considering counts 10 and 11. There's just if you don't find a conspiracy, it just gives out the Pinkerton instruction. What I'm saying is that there's two natural readings, and my reading would be the jury consider 10 and 11, the Pinkerton liability, in a vacuum. And my argument is that if there's two natural readings, the court should adopt the natural reading that sides with the defendant, because it was the government who asked for Pinkerton originally.
I might agree with you, but I guess I'm not understanding the second natural reading that you're talking about. So if you want to maybe...
Well, Judge, in the first trial, when it gives the Pinkerton instruction, if you find... the defendant guilty of a conspiracy in count one, you may also consider their liability.
It says if you first.
First,
find,
right.
Right.
But it doesn't explicitly say you stop considering Pinkerton. The Pinkerton liability instruction stops completely.
But what does first mean?
Well, they could look at it, but we don't know what goes on in the back of the jury room. So they could look at counts 2 and 11, or they could have agreed on all sorts of things. And it has to be what a rational jury. And I think we start guessing, we start looking at the hung count. I think 10 and 11 have to be viewed. There's no required order. They could have started with counts 10 and 11 or the substance counts and then got the conspiracy last, and they could have fully considered Pinkerton. And I think we have to look at why the government requested Pinkerton in the first place. They requested it because my client's defense, as the other therapist, was, yeah, those notes were fraud, but I didn't do them. That was wrong, but we didn't do them. So the government, to counter that, say, well, you didn't do them, but you knew of it, they asked for the Pinkerton instruction. So my argument is also that the government asked for the Pinkerton instruction. They can't say, well, Pinkerton doesn't apply, or it's thrown out the window. It's there. It's just the same as charging conspiracy once again in 10 and 11. So I see I'm out of time, and I thank you.
I think to some extent you are turning Pinkerton on his head. That is, according to the instruction, if you first found the defendant guilty of conspiracy, then you could find him guilty even though they didn't participate in the crime. Seems to me what you're now arguing is a reverse. If they didn't participate in a crime, they are not guilty of conspiracy. It sort of works backwards. And it seems to me would violate not only the express, but the spirit of this instruction.
That's the way I view the instruction is they can be, it was the jurors are the law presumes that they will follow the instructions fully. It doesn't presume, well, they're going to toss out Pinkerton. So my argument is just that when they considered counts, the substantive counts, they fully went through a Pinkerton instruction as they were instructed to. And the government's arguing, well, they couldn't have done that because they found on the hung count no conspiracy. But the argument to that is that we're not allowed to consider take any inference from a hung count.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Webb. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, James Pierce, United States. I'd like to take the arguments in the order that the defendants made them, unless, of course, the court wants to go elsewhere. Briefly on Defendant Rousseau's sufficiency arguments, Judge Wilson recited a number of the facts on which we rely here, his continual signing of the documents without paying any attention to them, recruiting trip to North Carolina and the bones in the closet comment, the direction of the therapist to sign, to conceal the fact that Namanda and Aricept, these Alzheimer's medications, should be omitted to avoid sending any red flags to Medicare. That's more than sufficient evidence for the jury to have convicted Dr. Rousseau as it did. I'd like to turn to the collateral estoppel issues. I think that's the one on which the court spent the most time.
Before you leave the sufficiency of the evidence issue with regard to the therapists, is my understanding correct that none of the therapists benefited financially from the alleged conspiracy, not $1?
No, that's not the government's understanding at all. I mean, the therapists were receiving the funds as a result of their participation. I mean, they were drawing a salary. They were not getting extra dollars, but their involvement in the entire HCSN, Healthcare Solutions Network, was perpetrating fraud.
And did they get more money depending on how many people they said were in the group therapy sessions?
Yes, they received more money if they had more patients in the sessions. So that's perhaps the most direct way in which to show that they received.
There was one that was an intern. What does that mean?
So Salafia was an intern. I don't think it frankly means much of anything.
Did she get paid?
She certainly got paid. She got paid more than $150,000 over the time of the conspiracy. Now, that was the least of the three therapist defendants that are before this court.
Salary or as compensation?
Correct, for her involvement, for misrepresenting the nature of the, quote, therapy, unquote, that she was giving, for writing fabricated notes, for writing cloned notes. She was then receiving compensation, as were Crabtree and...
So in order to keep her job, she had to write phony notes.
That's correct. Not only write phony notes, but also purport to give therapy that she was not actually giving, do all of the other fraudulent activities that the other therapists were doing. With that, I'll go ahead and turn to the collateral estoppel issue again, unless the court has further questions on the sufficiency claims. The core question in collateral estoppel, which is a narrow exception to the general principle that the government can retry mistried counts, is that if facts have been decided in a first valid proceeding, they cannot be relitigated in a subsequent proceeding. And that requires the court to say, so what facts have necessarily been decided? And as questions from the court, from Judge Rosenbaum, point out, the facts that the jury's verdict on counts 6 through 11 decided is that the therapists were not criminally liable for the 6 specific false statements in those notes. That's it. The indictment, as Judge Rebrano pointed out, specifically charged those notes. That verdict on counts 6 to 11 says nothing about, to go back to the colloquy I just had with Judge Rebrano, the therapist's involvement in giving fake therapy, so to speak, the therapist's involvement in both making omissions and commissions in their notes, omitting the fact that they were only giving fake therapy, and then saying they were providing certain kinds of therapeutic interventions, which clearly they were not. Testimony from multiple witnesses bears that out. So that is at base, the factual inquiry that the collateral estoppel question calls for. And that's the end of the case.
Well, isn't it a holistic view or approach? For example, at closing argument, did you argue those 6 notes, or did you argue that they had falsifies, that all the notes that they had worked with, that they had cloned all the notes?
So the argument at closing was broader than just the 6 notes. It was many of the facts I've already referred to about the therapist's involvement. But it was not, however, as my colleagues on the other side suggest, that the therapist's sole involvement was cloning notes, and that therefore that was... Now, I think that would pose a problem for us. If both our indictment and the trial evidence showed the therapist's role here was in cloning these particular notes, jury acquits on those, I don't see how we could retry on conspiracy. But the Ash inquiry is, you look at the whole record. You look at the charge.
Did you present evidence regarding those 6 notes?
We did, yes. And not at the retrial.
At the retrial, I'm
talking. No, sorry. At the first trial, of course, the jury rejected that. There was no evidence of the retrial. In fact, one of the issues in the motion to dismiss on collateral estoppel grounds was also an evidentiary challenge. The government said, we will not put on evidence of those notes. There's a sort of a subsidiary dispute, as I understand it now, which is whether one of the agents had asked, I think it's defendant Crabtree, about one of the notes, and then Crabtree made an incriminating statement, and then whether that was put on at the second trial. I've read the record. It's not clear that it was one of the 6 acquitted notes. But that actually, it's not clear how that would matter. It's not evidence of the note. And then as to sort of back further up, this court's decision in Gill actually says it's okay to use evidence that has been the basis of an acquittal, which makes sense. I mean, one single piece of evidence could be relevant not only for something for which there's been an acquittal, but also for counts that are still valid before the jury. But the shortest answer is no. At the retrial, the government did not put on evidence of those 6 notes. It put on evidence similar to the first trial, testimony from co-conspirators talking about, first of all, the whole fraud scheme at HCSN, but also the more specific involvement of the therapists, again, the playing movies in their quote-unquote therapeutic sessions, etc. I want to speak briefly to Larkin, the Larkin decision, 1979 and then modified in 1980. I think that's a very difficult decision to make sense of. I would say that both this court in Ohioan relied on it, and then the Fifth Circuit in Yeager, before it went up to the Supreme Court, relied on it. And after the Supreme Court in Yeager reversed, the Fifth Circuit on remand said, well, now the Supreme Court has overruled Larkin. I don't know, as a matter of procedure, in this somewhat particular situation where if the Fifth Circuit treats it as overruled, this court sees it as still valid precedent, it's the same precedential court, how the court makes sense of that. But even if we say, as far as this circuit is concerned, Yeager remains good law, Yeager does not preclude or did not preclude the retrial here. I think at most Yeager stands for the proposition that when you've got a conspiracy and then you've got substantive counts that themselves charge objects of the conspiracy, and the jury acquits on the substantive counts, and the government has relied solely on a vicarious liability or Pinkerton theory, then the government is precluded at the retrial from trying those defendants to the extent they match up with those specific substantive counts that were the basis of the acquittal.
What about the defendants' arguments that they have to match up because necessarily the jury must have found the defendants not involved with the conspiracy as it related to those notes? And if they weren't involved with the conspiracy as it related to those notes, they couldn't have been involved in the conspiracy at all because those notes were effectively the conspiracy.
That's too broad a reading of the whole line of collateral estoppel cases, and I think it's an unfair reading of the relevant record, both the charges and the evidence elicited at trial itself. In Bravo Fernandez, the case that the Supreme Court decided last term, it spoke specifically about using a guarded application, quote, guarded application, unquote, of the collateral estoppel doctrine in criminal cases. That means you look to what the jury necessarily decided. And so you can't just broadly say, well, the notes showed some kind of fraud, so therefore those fraud in those six notes covers the entire field of fraud that the therapists involved were involved with here. And then, not to repeat myself, but basically the trial evidence showed that the therapist fraud was far greater than just these six notes. It was a number of other notes, it was not just cloning, it was other types, and it was this fraud in the therapeutic environment. So under Larkin, under Bravo Fernandez, Yeager, et cetera, And there's the additional point. I think Judge Rosenbaum, you had the colloquy with a couple of my colleagues on the other side. The jury instructions make clear that the jury should not, any reasonable reading of the jury instructions from trial one says the jury doesn't even get to a conspiracy consideration because they don't, their acquittal can't work you backwards to conspiracy, essentially doing the work that Judge Rubino said of flipping Pinkerton on its head. I'm happy to address that further.
I'm sorry. When you get to the tardy, if you have some time to address.
I was going to move that direction to the dismissal of the jury. I'm happy to respond to a question.
What's the sequence of events there?
So we're in the middle of closing arguments at this point. The defendant and the government and Rousseau have given their closing arguments. The judge comes out and says, we have had a jury who is 45 minutes late, as Judge Rosenbaum pointed out, 30 plus 40, 15, because I think Mr. Mendez had gotten up and said, it's just 15 minutes, and the court corrected and said, actually, that's 45 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and replace this juror. At that point, there was an objection saying, well, wait a minute, the defense would like to be heard on this, and the court said, this juror has been late a number of times. I made clear at the outset, I'm not sure the judge said at this point, but the judge had made clear at the outset that being punctual was a critical part of being a participating juror. We're therefore going to call in an alternate and go forward with closing arguments. In our view, that is well within the discretion of the district court. Maybe there were things that the court could have done. Maybe calling a hearing would have made the record a bit more fulsome for this court's analysis.
Let's just talk about the factual record here.
Sure.
So the defendants say that, in fact, this juror had not been late and that you could tell that by reviewing the transcripts and the times the trial started. And if it started on time, then clearly the juror must have been there. What is your position on that?
So the record is not as full on this as one would like. I think we have basically that representation as against, as Your Honor put it, the representation from the judge himself who said this juror has been late a number of times. I think when this court looks to construe errors on appeal, it uses typically a clear error standard. I don't think it would be error for the judge himself to have made the observation this juror has been late a number of times.
So if we go back and we look at the trial transcripts, and I can't remember now if the judge started trial at 8 or 9 or whatever it was.
Nor do I. Yeah.
Let's say the judge started trial at 8, and every day for the 15-day trial begins at 8 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it seems like it would be contradicted. That statement would be contradicted by the record and could be clearer under those circumstances if that's the case. I don't know whether it is. I did not do that. At that level. I think that's going right after this hearing. So
I think that's fair. Although what it also doesn't take into account is what time did the court direct the jury to arrive? I mean, the court probably doesn't say court starts at 8, get here at 8. Probably says get here with a bit of lead time. I also did not undertake the analysis. My colleague on the other side did, to look at the specific start time. And again, maybe it would have been better for the judge to have held a hearing on this, but this is a discretionary standard. And this is one where when you're in the middle.
I'm not sure that there was necessarily a hearing needed if the facts are as the court said they were.
I agree.
I'm not sure that would have been an abuse of discretion. But if the facts weren't as the court said they were, that might change things, and that's why I'm asking these questions.
And I don't have any, as I said, I didn't undertake the same analysis my colleague did to look and see at what time. I took the judge's representation that this was not the first time. This was a juror who had been late a number of times. And then let me also
Was this the only African-American on the jury?
I do not know. I don't know.
We would know that if we had a hearing.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And how many of the defendants were African-Americans?
So Dr. Rousseau was Haitian American, and I don't know the racial background of the other defendants.
But you have to find then prejudice, or what's the role of race in the inquiry?
So the question of the defendants do have to establish prejudice. This court, or rather the precedential Fifth Circuit in 1978 in Rodriguez, said that the mere fact that the jury's composition changes, including a racial change to racial composition, isn't enough to establish prejudice. And this court in Acevedo more recently said, yes, prejudice is something under Rule 24C that the defendants have to show.
But the record here, we wouldn't know what the racial makeup of this jury.
Under this record, I believe that's correct. I believe there's nothing in this record that tells
us. Other than the juror who was substituted, the replacement juror was not a minority.
I believe that is on the record, and even the fact that the juror who was replaced was African American, I think that there are traces of that on the record. It's not confirmed either. I think one of the trial counsel gets up and says, "I believe the juror who was dismissed was an African American," and sort of had already made the objection about the substitution, and I think was just making a record on that point. But again, our core point here is this is an abuse of discretion standard. We are in the middle of closing arguments. This is a habitually late juror, and the district court has ample discretion, which it did not abuse under Rule 24C, in substituting out for an alternate juror. I see my time has run. I'm happy to answer any other questions or just sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you.
Mr. Mendez.
I was trial counsel, so I feel compelled to add whatever I can on this issue, even though I didn't brief it. Judge Rosenbaum, when Judge Scola says to me, when I say, give this juror a little more time, and he says to me, she's been late several days, I'm not about to have him be put on the stand and tell us how he came to that conclusion. That's all I need from Judge Scola to tell me at that point that he knows she's been late.
But I hear what you're saying, although I think that it wouldn't be unprofessional or inappropriate to say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my records show that she's been on time. I know you've got a lot of trials, but unless you don't know that she's been on time or he's been on time.
Right, and I said I didn't know that, and I didn't know that, and I don't know that, but except that Judge Scola said it, and to me that ends the inquiry there, especially if I'm going to be going on and trying the case for the next few days with him. But I do believe that the record will show that we began promptly, but maybe she wasn't there as early if 10 or 15 minutes before trial. Judge Scola expects us to be. There's a reference there where I walk in and he says, don't worry, you're not late, you're just not early. So I don't know what was going on, but I did say that let's give her more time because Judge Wilson, she was African-American.
Did you point that out to the judge? Did you say to the judge, she's our only African-American, or she's African-American, and she's going to be replaced by a non-African-American? Was that part of the discussion?
That was part of the discussion when Judge Scola later on excuses another African-American juror, and I beg him
not in the one before the court.
Not on that day, Judge, but when he excuses another one, and now I think we were left with maybe one African-American juror. I beg Judge Scola, please don't excuse this one because you already excused the other one. And by the way, there were Batson challenges during jury selection. So I was very sensitive to that fact.
I did. When you have a juror that you're making closing arguments to, you do tailor your arguments to your jurors. And that means whether they're men, women, older, younger, black, and white. And I had argued my closing arguments with the knowledge that I have two or three African-American jurors that I wanted to connect to, just as I did with the other persons. But there were specific arguments concerning the amount of money my client made, for example, which I thought would resonate with an African-American juror who might say, as I wish they would say, that don't hold it against my client because he made all this money. Look at the expert who testified, who was white. She makes more money. Why can't he make as much money as she does for being a psychiatrist? And on that issue of money, Judge, he did make that $800,000. All I can say is that the lion's share of that was made in the first year where Armando Gonzalez, the main co-conspirator, says, I gave him that money to help me develop the business. It had nothing to do with the claims. So Armando Gonzalez, who has an opportunity, is given a softball to bury my client, doesn't do that. And that harkens back to my argument that all these people could have said something directly that my client did or said, and no one did. And then finally, of course, that dovetails with the role, because if he was not there, and if he's going to be held accountable for not having been there, not having done his job, well, part of that is that he didn't exercise any control or supervision over anyone. He was a medical director in name only. And if he's going to get stuck with a conviction, I beg you to consider the same set of facts in support of my request for a lower sentence on the roll.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mendez. Mr. Klug.
I have so many things I'd like to say, and I'll be lucky to get one of them out, I guess. The 45 minutes thing. Mr. Mendez did not ask for 45 minutes. He asked for a few minutes, and then, I guess, looking at his watch, says 30 minutes, i.e. to 9:30. And then the judge takes that and pushes it out and says, well, that means 30 minutes more beyond the 9:15 that they hadn't actually even gotten to yet. So that would be 9:45. So it wasn't like this is definite, we have to have 45 minutes. We had no idea how long it was going to take the juror to get there, because the judge had already told the juror, don't even come in. And that's really problematic. It's really problematic when the judge, Mr. Mendez, is saying, I have no idea she's been late. I think that's an objection. Mr. Salafia's counsel then joins in the objection. And the record shows there was never a single moment's delay for any juror. So that this is a really important issue. The government says, Rodriguez says you have to show prejudice, but that's not how I read the en banc decision of this court in Peek v. Kemp, and that's not how I read the Supreme Court decisions that we cited in our case. This is a pretty fundamental issue, even apart from the particular focus. On the other issues, my client is the intern. I don't know whether the court wants to indulge me or a minute more or not.
We have your argument, Mr. Klug. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the brief time, I would like to say that in this case, there is no rational basis for Ms. Crabtree, the therapist, to be acquitted of counts 6 and 7, the therapy, false therapy notes counts, and still for a jury to find her guilty of the conspiracy, which is the standard the court would have to find for a retrial on the conspiracy count. These therapy notes were so important, and solely the role that the therapist played in this conspiracy. It was all about their doing these notes, which were allegedly false, in order to doctor the file so that if there was an audit, there would show therapy notes. That was it for the therapists. It is not too broad for the court to interpret the acquittal of those two counts to mean that she was not part of this conspiracy, because those notes were everything. If you go back and look at the closing argument by the government, you'll see they hammered away at the notes. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz, Mr. Webb.
I'll be brief. I just want to focus it on the court's attention. This was an overlapping conspiracy. In U.S. v. Alred, the three elements determine if there's one conspiracy or multiple. Is the object of the conspiracy the common goal of the conspiracy, the nature of the underlying scheme, and the the objective, I'm sorry, the overlapping of participants. When you look at all three elements, those are present here. Also, I just want to argue that the government never produced one witness or one client, former client that said Ms. Marks played movies. There was the only evidence of that was from a flipped co-defendant. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Swartz, I note that you were appointed to represent Mr. Crabtree, and the court thanks you for your service.